Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome. It's another Books of the Year podcast from your very good friends at Books of the Year, the podcast. An email, we've got Simon Sebag Montefiore, by the way, talking about two books.
Massive books.
Yep, 2,000 pages in total.
Goodness.
An email from Bridget, first of all, who wrote to Books of the Year at yahoo.com. Hello, Simon. Hello. I don't know anyone who's got a Yahoo email apart from us.
It's just us. We are basically keeping Yahoo going, yeah.
Bridget says, recently on an episode featuring Victoria Hislop, you discussed the sadness of finishing a good book. I thought you might like this word from the Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows, of made-up words, loose left. That's L-O-O-S-E-L-E-F-T. Adjective, feeling a sense of loss upon finishing a good book, sensing the weight of the back cover, locking away the lives of characters you've got to know. Loose left.
I like that.
Another podcast, and I have just read All the Sinners Bleed. Wow.
Yeah, it's Bridget. Very good. In fact, everyone who's mentioned to us, oh, I've read that book off the back of the podcast, or people that we've told, you need to read this book.
Yes.
No one has said, oh, that I didn't enjoy it at all. So I'm so glad it's found so many people's approval. This from Tony Walker on Twitter. We're still not calling it X. Tony says, thank you, Books of the Year, and Adele Parks for her brilliant book, Just Between Us. It was a real page-turner for any new readers. You don't need to have read the prequel to enjoy it. Another fantastic recommendation from Simon and Matt. Keep up the good work.
If you'd like to get in touch, you can email at any time, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. We're on Twitter, books of the year. We're on Instagram and Threads at Pick Any Page. We're not on Blue Sky yet, although I am on Blue Sky.
Are you?
I'm on Blue Sky.
Really?
Now. I just cannot stop accumulating.
You're on all these social media accounts. Wow.
How about that?
That is impressive, yeah. Don't you have to have an invite to go on Blue Sky?
Yes, I got an invite.
Oh, get you with your invite.
Thank you, Fancy Dan. right, let's have a chat with best-selling author and top historian Simon Sebag Montefiore. So I cannot think of any guest that I would rather have on the podcast right now than Simon Sebag Montefiore. Hello, you're very welcome.
Lovely to be here, Simon. Thanks for having me.
Because, for a whole bunch of reasons. So we're going to talk about two books. Your most recent book is called The World, A Family History, and is like 1,200 pages. It's a beast of a book.
It's a beast.
Yeah.
It was a beast to write.
Yes, I'm sure. But also, because of where the last couple of months have taken us, Jerusalem, for which you wrote the biography. And I saw a number of photographs of people on social media, of people who had bought it because they were suddenly aware that they knew so little or understood so little. And so they thought your book was a very good kind of primer.
Yeah.
Just as a starting place. So we're going to talk about both books, if that's okay.
Good idea.
But Matt and I, we're just talking before you came in. And the first question is kind of a way into Jerusalem, really, which is, and it needs an academic such as yourself to answer this question. Why is it that the universities in America, and to an extent here, have got themselves in such a mess about anti-Semitism, whereby the heads of Harvard...
Harvard, MIT, and
Penn.
Penn. Yeah.
When asked a very straightforward question about whether someone calling for Holocaust against Jews was against their bullying policies, and they could not condemn it. They could not say that it was, and it would all depend on circumstance. And it seemed to be that I don't know if you have any kind of insight into what has happened to the world of academia, particularly in America, maybe in this country as well, whereby they can't answer a question like that.
Well, it's all to do with ideology and history. And this is the result of allowing an ideology, the decolonization ideology, to take over many academies, many colleges in America, and in Britain, and to allow this unchecked to become the default analysis for the Middle East. And like so much in the culture and the discourse, it comes from America, of course, and because America is so dominant in our culture. And it really comes in part from the Black Lives Matter movement, where we in order to be anti-racism, which we all believed in, we accepted a whole menu of other ideas that were really sculpted in order to and devised to explain the history of race in America, which we'd all agree is a dark story, but then applied it to the rest of the world in a completely, literally aimless fashion. And so that whole analysis was used to analyse the Middle East. The Middle East is an incredibly complicated, nuanced mosaic of ethnicities and histories and narratives. And so the decolonisation ideology doesn't fit it and has no relevance to the creation of Israel or the tragedy of the Palestinian people, or in fact the creation of the modern Middle East. And so we've got to return to the history. And, you know, one of the reasons I wrote Jerusalem, the biography, which is a history of the Middle East using Jerusalem as a sort of easy lens to approach it through. One of the reasons I wrote that back in 2010 was because the two narratives of the two peoples, the Israelis and the Palestinians, was already so distorted. And I recognized that if they didn't recognize each other's narratives, there would never be peace in the Middle East. I mean, there were many right-wing, ultra-nationalist, messianic Israelis who denied the Palestinians were a people. There were many Palestinians who denied that there'd ever been a Jewish temple in Jerusalem. And so both of those things are idiotically and imbecilically ignorant, as are now many of the views we're now seeing on American right. campuses. And so this book, I really made an effort to try and not just to write a pro-Israeli, not to write a pro-Palestinian, anti-Israeli book, but to really encompass both narratives, because that is the only way there will ever be peace. And so it's nice that people are reading Jerusalem now, and it's they keep having to reprint it.
Yes. Do you feel as though you need to amend it?
I have amended it. And so that is just being edited right now, only because in the Middle East, when something really changes, nothing changed for 20 years. And when suddenly something really changes, even something written 2 years ago seems old fashioned now. Because October the 7th has changed a lot of things, most of them overwhelmingly for the worse. But out of a tragedy like this, sometimes in the Middle East, the shock, the blood, the soaking in blood, the drowning in blood can sometimes bring a sort of stunned weariness and realization that negotiations need to happen seriously and soon.
You've just said something there about the stunned weariness that people who aren't familiar with the history of Jerusalem, and I would have counted myself amongst those people, because I'm struck by something that Simon's mentioned before, which is you had I think it was a Middle East correspondent came on your show on 5 Live, and someone rang up literally with the question, as far as the Middle East is concerned.
Oh, yeah, it was a phone in to Jeremy Bowen, who was at the time of BBC. I mean, he's still, I think he's international editor, he's Middle East correspondent then. And it was listeners' questions. And you're right, the first question was, in the Middle East, who wants what and why?
And the answer took
20 minutes.
Yeah. 20 minutes to explain. Which, and what I take from that story is not just that it's a very complex history that needs to be explained, but also that there is a desire by people to understand more about this, but tempered with the, am I going to get people shouting at me because I've got things wrong? And that for me is the reason why the biography Jerusalem has been so popular in the last few weeks, is that people are like, I just need a book that's going to tell me dispassionately about this history without telling me you need to be on this side or this side. Because since the events of October 7th, people have felt there are things going wrong on both sides here. I just need someone who can dispassionately tell me about this.
And the loudest shouters have been, you know, have been the most extreme people, as always happens. But we're not used to that being shouted at. And in fact, but there are other things happening which are very interesting. I mean, one thing is when one wants to read up on this thing, there's no point in reading a book that is completely from the Israeli perspective. But there's equally no point in reading a book that calls all Israelis settler colonists and suggests that the whole enterprise, the whole Israeli state should be liquidated and everyone should be driven into the sea or killed. Because actually both of these rule out any kind of peace. And a peace is the only thing we want. And there are 7 million Jews. There are many millions of Palestinians there, and both of them deserve to have normal lives. And the only way that can happen is through incredibly difficult and complex decisions, by the way, and compromises, which can cost people their lives in the Middle East, as happened with Rabin and Sadat. But they should read. There are very few books that do both.
Yes.
And I wrote mine specifically to do that. I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm not saying some people think it's, you know, it's too nice to the Palestinians. Some people think it's too nice to the Israelis. But it's just an attempt to find a middle way.
I wrote down the word exceptionalism last night when I was thinking about what we were going to talk about, because it seems to encompass so much of what is going wrong, that people, nations, races, as soon as you think you are exceptional and therefore better than everyone else, you've got big issues coming down the track, well, and so have your neighbours.
Yeah, but Simon, the problem is with religious, you know, this is with the ultra-religious people, of course, you know, that they absolutely believe in something that is unchangeably true and the truth. And of course, negotiating with ultra-religious people is a big problem in diplomacy, which is why Iran is very difficult to deal with, you know, which is why the messianic crazies, who some of whom are in the Israeli government, are just impossible, and why Hamas is impossible to negotiate with.
Anthony Beaver, eminent historian, in his review of Jerusalem, I think it was in The Guardian, said this book is likely to confirm atheistic prejudices.
Yeah, well, the religious people are very difficult. And actually, you know, researching...
Do you think that's true?
Yeah, and researching my book in, you know, researching the book in Jerusalem, I spent years in Jerusalem. And, you know, I just don't need to go to Jerusalem again for some time. There was a saying in the Ottoman Empire, a Turkish saying, which was like, there's no one as evil as the inhabitants of holy cities. And by which they mean that the whole cities are sort of set up to sort of mulk, to get money out of, you know, devout pilgrims. But also religious people are impossible to negotiate peace treaties with. But what we now need more than anything is, you know, we need Hamas to be removed from the equation. We need the war to end. Far too many Palestinian civilians have been killed in this war. And for that I deplore. And, you know, the citizens, the civilians of both Israelis and Palestinians, I grieve for every one of them. But as soon as this is over, they need to get a new government in Israel. We pray, because this is the most disgraceful government that Israel's ever had. It's a democracy. Sometimes democracies do things that we loathe. And this government is just a disgrace. But then we've got to look at the Palestinian Authority, and that is a completely sclerotic institution, corrupt institution. We need on both sides to find, and this is hard, but there are such people, leaders who are brave, heroic, moderate, and willing to compromise, which can cost lives on both sides. But, you know, there are such people. And, you know, one of the themes of all my history books is leadership. You know, what makes a great leader? And so often Nehru said, you know, it's not that we're all giants, it's just that we live in great times. And out of this just unspeakable tragedy, it'll take years and years and years. Maybe no one will ever recover from October the 7th in Israel. And remember, in Israel, the fury is still going on because there are still hostages. And so every single hostage, and it means that the rage, the fear, and the outrage is still going on, hence the sort of excessive comments of many leading right-wing politicians, which I deplore. But at the same time, it'll take decades, maybe never, for Gazans to recover from this onslaught. But out of this, the negotiations, usually one would wait, say, oh, we must wait years, we must wait 10 years until everyone's recovered. But actually, you know, after the 73 war, it took 3 years to peace really to get going. After the Intifada, it took a few years for Rabin and Arafat. But in this case, we've got to start immediately because it's just so overdue. In the a pathway to Palestinian statehood is just essential. I dream of seeing that.
I'm conscious that we've not talked yet about what's inside the book, Simon, and I promise we are going to get to that. However, a little thing of mine when I'm reading nonfiction is I always skip to the acknowledgements first. And you've got some pretty impressive acknowledgements in yours. The Duke of Edinburgh and then Prince Wales, now King Charles, are thanked in your acknowledgements. That's not bad.
Which book is that? Is that
the Jerusalem? Oh, yeah.
I mean, the Duke of Edinburgh was fascinating because, of course, his mother was buried in Jerusalem. His mother was he was very nice to me because he was also, when I did the Romanovs book, I spoke to him about it. And he loved history, the Duke of Edinburgh. And of course, he had given DNA for the I know this is a book, the one book we're not discussing, but he'd given DNA to analyse the bones that were discovered in the forest in Russia, where they were, you know, of the Tsar's family. So there was he's always fascinating. And in the World Book, he was fascinating because he'd known the Shah really well of Iran. So, of course, he knew all sorts of interesting people. And Charles III, the king, has been always sort of supported me, but especially with my first book, Catherine the Great and Potemkin, where he wrote to all the Russian museums and helped me a lot to research it. And he loves books. And, of course, he's fascinated with history in the Middle East, and he's a sort of great reader.
There is a chapter in your book for Jesus Christ. We're speaking at Christmas time, so
yes,
and Jesus is getting a lot of press, you know.
Yes. Happy Christmas, guys.
The Jesus of your book is a very interesting character, very apocalyptic, and you certainly emphasise that. Tell me how your reading of the Gospels and other materials sort of how it filtered into the chapter on Jesus.
Well, with Jesus, with everything in the book, I just try to approach I try to approach all subjects as if I hadn't been told what to think already, and
yeah,
just to read the stuff. And so, you know, rather than just reading, there is an enormous literature on Jesus, obviously, but rather than just reading it, I just read, because all of it is based on the books of the New Testament, and specifically on the Gospels. And a lot of these people, it's almost as if they haven't gone back and read them, you know, so I just read all of them. And what struck me was that he was much less messianic and much more apocalyptic, by which I mean it was unclear how much he claimed to be the Messiah, to be the Christos. And it's unclear when people began to hail him as that. But what was clear is that he believed that from the Jewish scriptures and prophecies, that the apocalypse, the end days, was imminent, and he talked a lot about what would happen when that came about. I mean, one of the things I tried to do in all these books is kind of blend the different schools of history. So, for example, in the period of Jesus Christ, there's a whole lot of history books that are about Jesus Christ and Christianity and nothing else. Then there's a whole lot of books that are about the Roman Caesars who were contemporary. And they don't say anything about the Christians or the Jews. And then there's very few books about the Herod dynasty and what's happening in Judea. And so what I did was read all of them, read all the original sources that I could, and then merge them together into one. For example, there's always a King Herod in every kind of bit of the Bible, but
yeah,
no one realizes there were five King
yes.
Herods.
Which Herod at his
his testicles explode because of the maggots.
Yeah, that was Herod the Great.
That's Herod the Great.
And he's an extraordinary character in world history and in the history of his Judea. Yes, what a thing to happen. I mean, the bowels of King Herod's seemed... Because Christian historians later hated the Herods and therefore always that they devised the most appalling fecal explosions for their ends.
I'm glad we've got on to Herod because as I was reading the Jerusalem book, so the first few sections, I was obviously reading stuff that I didn't know anything about. And it got to the, as Simon has said, literally the title of the chapter is Jesus Christ. And I thought, right, here we go. Now I'm on safer ground because my RE lessons from many years ago are going to come to the fore. I'm going to feel much safer. And then it turns out Herod didn't order the slaughter of the innocents. And I was like, oh, right, hang on. That's the only thing I know about Herod is slaughter. No, he didn't. And the other point is, he did loads of other really bad stuff. It's not as if we're saying Herod or one of the Herods was an okay guy. He would be having his wife or instructing people to kill his wife if he didn't come back from some break. If I don't come back, make sure you kill my wife.
Well, that's a definition of love, isn't it?
Apparently.
Yeah.
Do your family know this?
Yes. Yeah, they do. But do you know Herod the Great is such a fascinating character because he was a sort of brilliant person, but also obviously flawed and ultimately mad. But I mean, he killed three of his own sons, which is a record, as far as I know. This brings us slightly to a link to the sort of family power and everything. But it's a sign of some of the great rulers of all time that they, you know, you've got to be absolutely ruthless to be a great politician, and to be a great dynastic absolutist monarch, you've got to be ruthless with your own family. And so many of the great rulers of all time, Herod the Great killed three of his own sons, Suleiman the Magnificent, Selim the Grim, Shah Abbas of Persia, Peter the Great, Ivan the Terrible, all of them killed their own sons, almost and oftentimes for the sake of the kingdom. But, you know, Herod the Great built modern Jerusalem, the Jerusalem of the old city that we think of today, was created by Herod the Great. He created this extraordinary Jewish temple, Judean Jewish temple on the Temple Mount. And as you said, his wife, he loved his wife. She was a proper Jewish princess in the sense that she was one of the Maccabean family, the Maccabee family. It's Hanukkah today. And so he married her, and she was very beautiful, and everyone adored her. And they had this kind of incredibly destructive love-hate relationship. I would describe it as a bit like Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor.
Wow.
You know, where they kind of were in love, they hated each other, they despised each other. I mean, he was an upstart. She was the ultimate kind of royal family of Judea. And when she betrayed him in the end, he almost reluctantly ordered her execution. And then kind of wandered the halls of his giant marble palaces thinking he'd seen her, and refused to bury her and preserved her in honey, and just it just sort of destroyed him. And then, of course, their sons together came back to hate him for killing their mother, and he had to kill them too.
Wow.
It's tough being a king.
It really is.
It's tough being Herod the Great.
So a useful jump-off point to the world of family history, which you say on page one, you talk about menacing times, by which you mean COVID and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Well, it feels as though maybe we're in even more menacing times at the moment. Can you just explain how you can? I mean, it's a huge book. I suspect few people will read it from the start to the end. They might dip into it. I don't know whether there is a way in which you would encourage people to read it. But what is the motor in your head deciding to write this extraordinary epic? The book of world history is an amazing thing to take on.
Thank you. I mean, the idea is that you can read it anywhere. You don't have to know any history. You can begin it at the end, where there's a sort of a prediction of what's going to happen. You can read it at the beginning. You can read it in the middle. I always suggest that people sort of begin, you know, if they want to just, they're not sure where to start, they just, they read the sort of 9th century Baghdad of Harun al-Rashid and the 1001 Nights, because one, it's a sort of actually even more relevant now. It's a different vision of Islam. It couldn't be more different from the vision of Islamicists like Hamas. It's a tolerant, knowledgeable, knowledgeable, cultured, cosmopolitan, sensual, poetical world of Arab Islam. And it's the height of Arab culture in world history in Baghdad under the Abbasid dynasty, where it's filled with gorgeous singers, poets, writers, poets, mathematicians, astrologers. And
so start there.
So that's a great place to start. But the idea of the book is this. World history is really the tonic for troubled, terrifying, menacing times. It's getting more menacing. If you want to know, you know, where Israel came from, where Russia and Ukraine came from, what's happening in Venezuela, and who is Simon Bolivar? Because Venezuela today, which may be about to invade Guyana, is a Bolivarian republic. So all of these things are in the book. So that's that. But it's also meant to be a great entertainment that you can read and enjoy. And the idea is that most world histories give a great perspective to what is happening in the world. And if you step back a couple of paces, one, it's slightly consoling for us because we are deeply unsettled at the moment. But on the other hand, it's also a very good way to understand. Take the modern Middle East. Most people don't know how it was created and just think that Israel is just the only country to have been created recently in the Middle East. When in fact, you know, all the countries in the Middle East were given independence at almost exactly the same time as Israel was created. Israel isn't really that new compared with the others. Syria was only created in 1945 to 46, for example, just to jump back to that subject. So that was the idea. But the idea is this. World histories, which I love, and there are many, many good, very good ones, are always a little detached from the actual humans that are taking place. There are lots of lists of commodities and that sort of thing, and lots of stuff about wheat and coal. But the people are missing. And on the other hand, biographies are getting longer and longer. You know, the new biography of Kissinger is 1,000 pages before he's even met Richard Nixon.
And you credit him in this book, Henry Kissinger?
I credit he read his section of the book, which is rather amazing because it's a bit like having kind of Metternich read about
the book.
He corrected a few things. And by the way, I didn't have to take his corrections, and don't think that this is a sort of cleansed version by Henry Kissinger, but there are a few things. Amazingly, he actually corrected a few sort of dates that I'd got wrong to do with his relations with Mao Zedong, for example, and sort of said like, no, Mao Zedong never mentioned that during the meeting, which was a pretty amazing message to get. So the idea of the book, The World of Family History, was to find a way to combine the span of world history and this sort of intimacy, the juice of
the
biography.
Families,
of
yes.
biography. And I thought families were the perfect way to do it. For a long time, I couldn't think how the hell to do it. My mother said to me, who was 90-something, she said to me, Simon, give the money back. It's just not worth it.
But thanks, Mum.
Thanks, Mum. But then families proved a brilliant way because in some ways it's very traditional, you know, dynasties. But in another way, actually it's brilliant because there's no better way to cover diversity. I mean, this is the most truly diverse and global world history yet written, I think. Women play a huge part in families. So female history is filled with female history. And there's much more about Africa. It's much less sort of, there's much less Tudors in here than you'd find in most world histories. In fact, the Tudors aren't really in here.
It's probably a good thing.
I think that's a good thing because I think we've had enough Tudors.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So did most of the families choose themselves? I wonder could you give us an example of a family that you were surprised to be including?
Yeah, I mean, a really good example of that is, of course, slavery is a huge part of it. And this is one of the things from the present day, which was good to include because slavery has been so undercovered. So, of course, I covered Atlantic slavery. And that led me, for example, to tell the story of the Hemings family, Sally Hemings and Jefferson, and treating the Hemings, an enslaved family, as one of the families. So that not all the families in here are royal families. There are also enslaved families in here. So that was one family that was interesting to me. But another more interesting one, slavery led me to look at the other big slave trades, which aren't so fashionable. And so I covered not just West African slave trade to the Americas, which we all know about, the Atlantic slave trade, But the East African slave trade, which I knew nothing about, and this was tens of millions of slaves being traded from East Africa to the Arab world, to Iran, to India. And this was all controlled by one family for about 200 years, and that was the Imani royal family. And I didn't realize this, and I don't know if you knew this, but East Africa was a single empire of the Imani royal family, the Bin Said family, that still are the royal family of Oman, you know, the Sultanate of Oman in southern Arabia. They conquered an empire that went all the way from Mogadishu, that's Somalia, all the way down through Kenya, including through Tanzania, Zanzibar was their capital, all the way down to what's now Mozambique. And they had all of that was one empire, and it was basically a slave trading empire run by Arab families, specifically this royal family, and they controlled Oman and East Africa. And so I covered that slave, that was one of the most fascinating slave trades. Another one was the slave trade run by the Ottomans, but earlier than them, the Giray family of the Crimea, who controlled southern Ukraine and Crimea, and they were descended from Genghis Khan. So those are three families that you wouldn't expect you'd find.
I tell you, as I was reading the book, I was fascinated by the idea that you'd chosen family as being this prism that we would see history through. When we look back on history and we talk about family, the obvious thing is to say, you know, kings passing the throne down to their sons. And sometimes my instinct is that we get a bit snooty about the idea, oh, how ridiculous that, you know, the divine appointment has decided that the king will hand it down to his son, and just because it's the same family, therefore they're better better equipped to be able to deal with the kingdom. And then I sort of remembered that in America, where they obviously got rid of their royal family and the idea of handing things down father to son, they had a spate of elections from, I think it's 1980 till 2016, where you had either a Bush or a Clinton on the ballot box.
And now we've got a Kennedy.
Yes, and the Kennedys keep coming back. And my thought there was it doesn't say quite so much about those individual families. It says a lot about us as people, that we instinctively feel that certain families are suited to power.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge history in democracies of dynasties, and I call them demo dynasties. I mean, the good thing about them is you can unelect them. You don't have to stick with them. But you're right. I mean, some of the great families of the last century have been in the two greatest democracies on earth, America and India. So in America, you've got the Kennedys and the Bushes and the Roosevelts. In India, you have the Nehruvian dynasty, the Nehru family, the Nehru Gandhi family, which ruled for 60 years of and may well rule again one day in India. In Pakistan, look at the government today. The names Sharif and Bhutto are the sort of key names in that government. I mean, both of them are the sort of brothers, sons, grandsons, great-grandsons of presidents and prime ministers of Pakistan. We know when we think of sort of royal, you know, family dynasties are in our rather secular, very sensible democracies. Actually, an interesting thing is that in the countries of Northern Europe, where we have constitutional monarchies, Britain, Holland, the Scandinavians, there aren't really political families anymore. But in the places that don't have constitutional monarchies, like America, and many other places, you see these demo dynasties. So demo dynasties are one form, and they're all in the book: the Kennedys, the Bushes, the Nehrus, the Kenyattas of Kenya, the Marcoses. They're all in the book. But another form of political families are, of course, you've got absolute monarchies now, are never more important. You know, where is Putin going now? Putin is flying in to see the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, the President of the UAE now. He's then going on to Iran, where there is an elected monarch, in effect, the supreme leader, who has ruled Iran like an absolute monarch since 1989.
Wow.
Yeah. And by the way, who is an evil dictator, one of the most evil dictators on earth. But because they're religious, we insist, and this brings us back somewhat to what we were talking about at the beginning of this, because our societies are now, the church is so unimportant, we have no moral structures. Even though we don't, in our own lives, we don't want religion, formal religion, that's left us very liable to be impressed with Islamicism, with extreme religious belief. And so we see again, Hamas, for example, a lot of us, but a lot of people are somewhat awed by the sort of, by the passionate fanaticism. Mm-hmm. And of course, on the left, it's very unusual to criticize Iran, even though Iran is a brutally repressive monarchical dictatorship that kills girls on the street for not wearing covering their heads correctly. This is a weird thing about modern progressive leftist.
Yes, and I can think of a few who were quite happy to go on Iranian state television and take the Iranian money. And you're thinking, do you know how they treat gay people?
That's exactly right.
Anyway. Just one other thing. You talk about slavery as a theme, and I suppose this is connected in a way, but if you're writing a history of the world and tying directly into the news today and almost certainly for the next few decades, is migration.
Yes.
And the great sort of sweeps of migration. And you wonder whether, particularly influenced by not just global conflict, but also because of climate change, there will be more people on the move for the rest of our lives, for the next few generations, than ever before. And we are going to have to work out what to do with that.
That's right. I mean, because armies are sort of generally kind of men riding horses or marching riding in tanks. But migrations are families in movement. And of course, there were many times in the book. I mean, the Genghis Khan family, for example, the Attila the Hun all have huge roles in the book. But migration is going to be the greatest challenge that we in our, what I call the comfort democracies, are going to face. And the simple truth is that neither the left or right is being at all truthful in any of our country, in any of our Western European countries, or the United States, about what migration means, because it's generally regarded among slightly left of centre people, centrist people, I would say, that if you criticise migration, you are being very right wing. But the fact is, this is just the beginning. These little boats, I mean, you know, the clue is in the name, little boats. That this is actually tiny compared to what is about to come down the road, because if many of the states in, say, West Africa or the Middle East fail, as they are failing, because one of the things we're going to see is a challenge to all the republics created, the new states, the nation states created after 1945. They all look like democracies. They've got presidents and elections. But actually, many of them are disintegrating. And many of those people, if those countries don't work, will want to come north to us. And we need to be ready, much more truthful about how on earth we're going to cope with this.
OK, well, as we wrap up then, with that, it's a time of year for comfort and joy. Give us a reason to be, because you are quite optimistic.
Yes, I am.
You are an optimistic person. Looking, you're looking panicked now. Give us a reason to be optimistic.
Well, we started off by talking about, you know, apocalypse and Jesus Christ. One of the weird features of human existence is that since the beginning, you know, the third century, millennia BC or earlier, human beings have always been convinced that the end of the world is imminent. Ever since the beginning, and now we have more reasons to fear it. You know, we've got nuclear proliferation, we've got climate change, and we've got AI, the terrifying but possibly positive developments of tech. And so all those things are deeply worrying, but all of them also can be positive in the sense that climate change, you know, the world is beginning to realise that climate change is a real thing. Oftentimes we criticise the leadership of places like China and India, but actually these big countries, actually a very few people can ultimately make decisions on climate change. And maybe that's a good thing. Nuclear proliferation could be disastrous. But on the other hand...
I asked you for optimism here.
On the other hand, nuclear power is going to be a much bigger thing. We're going to return to civilian nuclear power, and that's a good thing. And AI is one of the most terrifying things to happen to us. But on the other hand, it could give us much, if it's correctly used and controlled, it could give us much more opportunity to work less, to earn more, and spend more time with our families. This book and world history is both an indictment and a celebration of humanity. We've got all of these terrifying things, but ultimately this book is also a celebration of the ingenuity, the flexibility, the loving kindness of humans. And that's why I'm ultimately optimistic about the future.
There you go. I think your next book should be called
Christmas.
On the Other Hand.
Happy Christmas.
But if ever there was a time to understand more about Russia, China, India, the Middle East, yeah, now is that time.
Yes.
And these are two books I would suggest that are, it might break your back carrying them back from the shop, so order them online. But anyway, Jerusalem, the biography, and The World of Family History. Fascinating, fascinating, all the way through every single page. Simon Sebag, Montefiore, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me. Lovely talking to you guys, and happy Christmas.
Thank you. And our special Q&A episode will be with you in a couple of days.